The U.S. has 6 million COVID cases, over 183,000 deaths here.
The stock market has returned to record levels. Meanwhile, almost 11% of U.S. households did not have enough to eat in the previous 7 days.
Two-thirds of the 100 largest school districts in the country are starting the school year entirely online.
Tonight, 21 California wildfires are threatening community after community.
You don't feel my pain? All I ask for is reform, my reform. Is that too much to ask for? Please tell me.
COVID, unemployment, police shootings, unrest, hurricanes, wildfires, a high-stakes presidential election. In short, 2020. Unsurprisingly, the CDC reports anxiety and depression are up compared to this time last year. Young people and people of color are particularly affected. They suffer from higher anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. We're going to talk about this with clinical psychologist Dr. Aldwan Tart. Hi, Aldwan.
Thank you.
And also, Sean Fletcher is a professor at San Jose State. His research focuses on health disparities among Black men. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. All right, Aldwan, let's begin with you. The CDC says that anxiety and depression are increasing. And what does it look like specifically in the Black community?
The need for mental health services is at an all-time high. I mean, so you look at systemic racism, which is front and center. You look at being in the middle of a recession, so you're talking about layoffs, you're talking about stress and strain, especially if you're talking about African-American men, their profession is the core of their ego. And so when you combine a recession with COVID-19 and a pandemic of racial inequality and police brutality, and you see that throughout social media, you see African-Americans getting a double and triple dose of stress. And so what we see is an all-time high need for mental health services. So there's not a psychologist that I know who is not booked thoroughly because of the need in the African-American community.
And booked with existing patients or new patients or both?
Both. So I've had clients that we've treated successfully that have come back in because of one, they see what's happening in the news. And so it's lit something inside of them. And so it's caused them anxiety, depression, and anger, but also their kids. So their children are seeing the same things on Instagram, on TikTok. And so their kids are now outraged and asking questions. So we see a double dose of not only clients coming in, but also their kids asking for mental health services and how to deal with what's going on in this country right now.
Sean, I understand that you have suffered from stress, anxiety, panic disorders, panic attacks. Can you talk about how you personally have dealt with mental health crises?
Sure. It is something that's near and dear to me, and I spoke about it in a TED Talk, is that it's very important to challenge the stigmas that surround it. First, I had to deal with it myself, that it was nothing to be ashamed about, that it was something that I could deal with, that it was counter to many of the different narratives that I grew up with as how I was socialized in viewing mental health as being a sign of weakness, perhaps. I had to challenge those stigmas. And that then allowed for me to go and seek the advice, the professional services that are available that Dr. Tart just mentioned. And it allowed for me to first reshape my thinking and then move forward and take the myriad of resources that we have in our community to deal with mental health in a very healthy way.
Well, talk about that, how you countered the stigma. What was the stigma? How did you grow up thinking about mental health as a Black man?
I grew up in the Bible Belt. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. And there's a very healthy tension that existed between white and Black community. And there were oftentimes socialization as it related to health in general, but specifically mental health. Oftentimes we only heard about therapists when there was some clinical, psychological, or neurological disorder that was taking place. And we viewed mental health as something that we either needed to move to some of our institutions, meaning church, religion, community, some of these institutions that, quite frankly, we did not see a professional in the bunch. However, those were many of our mechanisms to cope. Mental health and mental health resources was oftentimes viewed as something that the white community took advantage of. you know, folks who lived in a plush existence, who lived a very charmed life, they would go and talk to their therapist about charmed life problems, champagne problems, as we called them. We didn't see that as something that was attainable for us. And then many of us were underinsured or not insured at all.
Interesting. So so people would think, oh, that's for them. Counseling, mental health, help, that is for them, not for us. We don't do that. We deal with our problems in the church.
In many respects, and not just the church, our communities. We look to one another as safe havens.
Yeah, a different experience. But me being a psychologist for 21 years, I have the pastors, the deacons calling me on a regular basis to actually help out. So the beauticians, fire and police, psychiatric hospitals, pastors, and those over marriages, those are the ones that are contacting psychologists on a regular basis. And also me being trained in community mental health. Now, if you're, and I was trained out in Los Angeles. And so Dr. Fletcher's right. So I'm from Atlanta, but when I went to Los Angeles, mental health services were kind of the norm. Mm-hmm. Even if you were in an impoverished community, there was a mental health clinic on every corner. Matter of fact, there were two psychologists posted in each school just to deal with mental health needs.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure that exists anymore in the schools because of budget cutbacks.
Every school system has a bevy of school psychologists, in addition to licensed clinical social workers, in addition to 2 to 3 counselors per school, and it's still not enough to meet the mental health needs of kids on the elementary, middle, high school, and college level.
And the interesting part about that, just to add to what Dr. Tart was just saying, there tends to be cultural barriers to taking advantage of many of these resources that do exist.
That's true.
Do you find that still the case? You're out in San Jose. Do you find that still the case?
I find it to still be the case by and large, yes. I think we're absolutely light years away from how we view mental health in the African-American community than when I grew up around the 70s and 80s, especially with the younger generations. They view it differently.
Mm-hmm. The big issue is trust. And so we need more professionals. I think it's only 4% of African-Americans are psychologists. And you start talking about African-American male psychologists, I mean, you might be in the 0.005%. All right. So if you're in Atlanta, you can find African-American psychologists. Still difficult, but it's much more difficult in San Jose. So when we start talking about access, it's really a trust issue. So I know that I have some mental health issues and I want to talk to someone, but by and large, we want to talk to people who relate, who connect, and get our experience, especially in what's going on in 2020 with the Trump administration. People don't want to have to explain racism. They don't want to have to explain sexism. They don't want to have to explain what's going on in current America and have their realities invalidated. They want to start with someone already getting their reality. And that's a big obstacle. Trust and having more visible African-American therapists and therapists of color, and also therapists trained to work with people of color who understand culturally where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's a great point. So speaking of young people, the CDC just did a survey, a recent survey, and young people scored the worst. And these are 18 to 24 year olds. 25% of them answered yes when asked if they had seriously considered suicide in the past 30 days. 63% reported either anxiety or depression. So that those numbers are just off the charts. And Aldoan, what are you seeing in your practice, specifically with young people? What are they saying to you?
Let's look at it from a developmental standpoint. You're coming out at 18, 24, trying to find employment. Either you're going to college, you're entering to the workforce, and then oftentimes that means that you're moving away from your family for your first job. And so we couple unemployment, being in a college, being away from home, having financial strain, racism, and then trying to be able to connect in the middle of a pandemic to where all of your social things that you would do for well-being, the gym, maybe going to a club, connecting with a fraternity, a sorority, hanging out, all those things are gone. Even church in person is gone. So it does not surprise me that that base, while trying to find themselves, not only find their social network, but also who they are, would be experiencing a high degrees of depression and suicidal ideation.
Yeah. Sean, you have young kids. You both have young kids, I understand. So how do you talk to them and monitor their mental health? How old are your kids, by the way?
I have a 7-year-old daughter, Mackenzie, and a 4-year-old son, Caleb. And just this weekend, case in point, my daughter asked me why so many Black people were being killed, because she had just seen a spot that I was on talking about, ironically talking about Chadwick Boseman's passing, but mm-hmm. she yet saw another Black person dying. Mm-hmm. And she asked, with tears in her eyes, she asked my wife, she said, why are so many Black people dying? Men in particular, she asked. And that was a moment that we had, I had to, and my wife had to, in the moment, we had to try and figure out a way to have a conversation with a 7-year-old that would not jade her for the foreseeable future about the world that she's about to grow up in and hopefully be, if it's up to us, be a contributing, healthy member of society. So we talked to her and we reassured her and we ensured that we were safe, that daddy is safe, your uncles are safe, your little brother is safe. Her little brother's too young to process this, but she needed reassurance.
But how do you say, all the Black men you know in your life are going to be fine and safe? You don't know that.
We don't know that. Our institutional loved ones, parents, relatives, teachers, so on and so forth, who helped shape our worldview, they didn't know either. They had no assurances that the world was going to be what they said it was going to be, but they gave hope. There's no substitute for hope.
Yeah, they need to see tangible things, because when they see TikTok and they see these things, they need to understand. Look around you. Outside, you see the cops coming by. You don't have to be afraid of the cops. You see your father, you see your uncle, you see your grandfather, you see the men in your life. They're still there. So what you see on TV is not necessarily your reality. So for kids, you have to be able to help ground them. They'll think that everyone, they'll catastrophize. And mm-hmm. to be able to give them a base, you help them understand that that is one Black man. That is happening in Minnesota, but there are thousands of African-American men in Minnesota, in Milwaukee, in Atlanta, who mm-hmm. are safe. But unfortunately, the ones that you see were mistreated. But by and large, and you take them for a drive sometimes. Do you see those people walking? Do you see mm-hmm. him walking? Do you see? And then that helps them to be grounded in reality, and it takes them off of social media and allows them to be able to see what's going on in their own community. And also, I wanted to add earlier, you talked about kids. Yeah. I see a lot of young kids. It's three things that young kids are worried about. That's the population that we're not worried about, that we're not focusing on, and we should be. We should be focusing on kids 6 to 18. Those are the kids that are the most stressed. What are they stressed about? Believe it or not, one, they're stressed about grades. All right, that is something that most parents really underestimate. The number one stressor for kids is grades. Number two, which is connected, disappointing their parents. Parents are flabbergasted. They don't think that kids care, but kids care about disappointing their parents. And then number three, which is real time, a disappearing and a lack of a social life and social connection. Social media mm-hmm. is not enough. And so now that they don't have access to their peers, because many are learning from home, kids are complaining about grades, disappointing parents, and lack of connection and a social life.
Yeah, and it seems like this has gone on for a lot longer than anyone anticipated. And so I think there's also this idea, Sean, that you raised, this idea of hope. And I mm-hmm. wonder if you could both address this when we're talking not just about kids, but everyone who's experiencing increased depression and anxiety. I mean, even Michelle Obama admitted to low-level depression, that it could be defined as also a crisis of hope. Like, where is the hope? And how do you hold on to the idea that things will get better or could get better when things look pretty bad right now, and they look like they could be bad for quite some time, even after there is a vaccine?
Well, I think it starts with the nucleus. There takes a core nucleus of people that you trust who shape your beliefs and values, and only they can reinforce it. Not, as Dr. Tarp mentioned, social media influencers that you consume so much. That's why we limit screen time from our daughter, because you should get those messages from us, to where if you look without, you're gonna see hopelessness. At mm-hmm. best, you'll see hopelessness. If you look within, meaning the core nucleus, of our cultural defining norms and values and belief systems, that is your true source of hope. And for many, it differs. I am a believer. My family, we are believers. We are strong people of faith. So that is part of our core nucleus. We love family. We believe in that. We believe in mental health outlets. We believe in all of the things that will make us healthy, mind, body, and soul.
Alderman?
Yeah. So you mentioned a protective factor when it comes to hope is faith. It's belief in God. I mean, that is why you have the lowest suicide rates around with African-American females, because they have the highest level of religiosity. So when we start talking about faith, you're talking about African-American women in churches. You can lean on the fact that God has seen pandemics before. And so we start talking about the faith community, and we start people going to their churches and being part of discipleship groups and being connected, leaning on faith, especially for people of color, is a protective factor. And so that is why we have to instill this in our children, this in 18 to 24, to help them understand how to sustain during times of stress, that God is still on the throne. You can find the silver lining in the dark cloud. Like, for instance, we talk about Black Lives Matter. Now people of color have more power than they've had as far as being on social media and bringing truth to light and actually getting the media to respond. But companies are afraid. Companies are aligned. Look what the NBA has done because of the players union galvanizing. Look at women's rights and the women that are in Senate and changing the face of politics. All right. And we're seeing that is coming out of this, that change. We can't just have a racist America, because now we're at a crisis. We have to diversify. So if you can find the silver lining in the dark cloud, if you can find the positives, families coming together, marriages being built, families spending more time than they ever had because mom and dad were traveling. If you can find a silver lining and lean in your hope in God, you can have hope for the future.
All right. I like the way that we ended on an up note. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Alderman Tart, clinical psychologist in the Atlanta area. Sean Fletcher, professor at San Jose State, where he does research on the health disparities among Black men. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have a longer version of that interview up on the Press Play podcast, so be sure to subscribe to that. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay. Coming up, how to have a more beautiful city. A small thing might actually go a long way, and that is the streetlight. A new design has been chosen for the streets of Los Angeles. We'll talk about that. Plus, a new condo complex that could provide a blueprint for how to design for COVID in the future. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. L.A. is full of Instagram-worthy backdrops. Among the most popular are the rows of old streetlights in front of LACMA by artist Chris Burden. But aside from that art installation, most people probably don't give a second thought to the lights keeping L.A. streets alit at night. Well, the city wants to change that. The mayor's office held a design competition for a new streetlight, and the winner was announced today. Here to talk about it is Frances Anderton, KCRW's resident design and architecture expert. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, there are about 1,000 to 2,000 new streetlights installed every year, so this is a big deal. And it is, well, these streetlights are a permanent fixture in our lives, literally. Tell us about the winning team.
The winning team is called Project Room. They turn out to be LA-based. This was a surprise to the jury. We should say there was over 100 entries. There was a lot of interest in this competition. The group that won is what one might call emerging talents. They're a community of artists, curators, architects, designers. So they've done a very interesting design. They actually themselves call it Super Bloom. And what that refers to is that they have essentially created a very flexible design that is composed of green tubular steel, what you could call stems. And you cluster these stems together, and each stem extends upwards and then serves a different purpose. So one might become an antenna. One might curve to then become the support for a lantern. Another one might curve at a lower level to provide a pedestrian light. Another one might become a little loop that might hold a banner or perhaps a shading structure. So it's this very clever kind of flexible structure, very adaptable, that also evokes flowers, sort of the organic world. Lead designer on the project was Sandy Yum, and she's told me that they took their inspiration, in fact, from a Picasso painting, a painting called Bouquet of Peace.
It's this figure, this painting of these flowers with these two hands that come in and sort of hold the stems of these flowers together. And so on top of that, the sort of familiar quality of these kind of columnar structures that you normally see of these historical lights that everyone really loves here in LA, it's kind of inverted.
So that was, I guess, part of the reason why this was chosen, right? Because it harkened back to the grand old street lights of yore?
Absolutely. Yes, you mentioned the lights that are now an artwork in front of LACMA. LA street lights are really part of LA's sort of civic history. And what the jury and certainly Christopher Hawthorne, the city's chief design officer, was looking for was something that absolutely was of our time, but also evoked the elegance, the aspiration, even perhaps the grandeur of those lights.
One of the things we really liked about the design was how much it seemed to have a kind of LA sensibility. And what I mean by that is that it seemed to refer back to the great historic streetlight designs of LA's past, but to do it in a way that seemed really fresh and contemporary. It's not trapped in nostalgia.
So not trapped in nostalgia, but still in keeping with the DNA of the city. And really, LA's lights back in the day were so impressive to people that visited that a man named Charles Mulford Robinson, who was a leader of the City Beautiful movement, back in 1909, he called LA's streetlights the handsomest in the United States. And we should say that they were...
the handsomest.
You laugh.
It's very masculine.
It's interesting. It is very masculine. Although at the same time, if you think back to it, those lights actually could be very feminine, you know, as well. They often had a sort of floral quality, and they had these sort of almost voluptuous bulbs, you know, that would come off the top of these lanterns. But the thing about these grandiose lights is that they weren't everywhere. They did tend to be in the more affluent areas. And one of the points that has been made emphatically by Christopher Hawthorne and by the city is that the goal of this project is to bring civic beauty all over LA to every income level.
So they'll be everywhere. But my question is, look, we're in a pandemic. This competition happened before COVID. The city just announced they're going to furlough 15,000 employees. Do they have the money to install street lamps all over the city?
Excellent question. And I did put that question in front of Christopher Hawthorne as well. And he said, for starters, they're now entering a prototyping and testing process. And in that process, cost and affordability of the materials and all of that is going to be very much front and center. However, he would point out, as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, that they do have to install thousands of lights a year. The lights cease to function, they have to be replaced. So I think the argument would be, if they're going to be replaced, why not replace them with a new lovely light rather than the utilitarian one that we've had for years that has given rise to that condition that you mentioned earlier, where people don't even notice the lights because they're not worth noticing. So he would say they want to make them affordable, they want to make them flexible, adaptable, they want to have the parts be interchangeable so you can replace parts and not necessarily have to replace the whole light. And hopefully one can meet a budget that makes it doable even in these circumstances.
All right. While I have you, I want to ask you about something else. This is a new condo building called Garden House in Beverly Hills, and significant because of the designers and also because of what this design might signify going forward when it comes to thinking about COVID and how people want to live.
Sure. Yes. No, this is a set of 18 condos that have opened up in Beverly Hills on Wilshire at Stanley. And it's one of those buildings that you just have to take a diversion from your drive, wherever you are, to go and look at. It's really an incredibly imaginative, fun design. It's called Garden House because the notion is that this is a sort of rethink of the California dream house in the yard, but for a time when you're building multifamily. Now, these are definitely higher end. These are costly condos. However, they have built into the design various features that seem to have made them absolutely appropriate for the era of COVID. And I'll quickly explain how. Mainly because of the access to the outside and the constant flow of ventilation. You walk in and there is a blast of sky. And then up you look, you've got ventilation just swirling around, a real sense of airiness. From that lobby, you can go to one of several elevators. There's almost an exclusive elevator per condo. Obviously, again, very luxury. However, there's been a lot of talk about elevators and people's nerves about getting into group elevators. So this is kind of a nice feature for people who go into that building with those concerns. And then you get to your little house, and there you have one, maybe two private decks attached to your condo. So very much it's they've managed to put kind of the so-called indoor-outdoor California kind of living up on top of a building. And this building was designed years ago, way before COVID. But they also have made a feature of the fire stairs. Now, again, if people don't want to use an elevator, one of the things they might do instead is use the fire stairs, except in many buildings, many office buildings, many residential buildings, the fire stairs are miserable, dark places that you don't want to be in. They've given them a big glass window, so it becomes a pleasure to walk up the stairs. So that becomes an option. So it's as if you had to kind of script a design for a COVID-era multifamily building, this would be it.
Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA podcast. Frances, thank you.
You're very welcome, Madeline.
Coming up, Good Foods. Evan Kleinman is here with LA's best bakeries and how to make sticky buns.
To be honest, it's a recipe I've been making since I was a child from the Pepperidge Farm baking book.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chops?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
That means Evan Kleinman is here for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. She is the host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, I'm so excited about today's conversation because
it involves sugar.
It involves sugar and fat and deliciousness, and
There you go.
we're going to talk about sticky buns later. But first, we're going to talk about bread because at first during this pandemic, a lot of people were baking bread, but maybe they got sick of that and now they want to still eat good bread, but they don't want to bake it themselves. And there are places to get great bread in town, right? And you're going to give us your recommendations.
Yeah, and I would say especially when it's going to hit like 100 degrees over the weekend and you're going to
And
be
no one
home
wants to bake.
for, well, I mean, we're all home for more than just 3 days, but you have that nice break of Labor Day weekend and perhaps you want to make a bruschetta, which we talked about earlier. And there are places to get really great bread and pastries and savories. I feel like some of the places where you get the greatest bread have become like these all-in-one shops where you can really get some good stuff for the house that will keep you going. I should say this is all in the European tradition that we're talking about today. We will cover bakeries from other traditions, Anon.
Okay. Anon, dot, dot, dot. All right. So let's go by neighborhood. Let's start with downtown L.A.
Okay. Downtown L.A., there's Bread Lounge, which is Ron Zimone's expansive inventory of pastries, breads, and cafe savories. His by way of Israel.
What's a cafe savory, by the way?
So a savory is like all the things that you expect to get for lunch or an early dinner, things that go beyond just the sweets.
Yeah, so like little tiny quiches, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've always been amazed by how large their inventory is, how many different things he's making. But I have to say my favorite reasons for going down there as a person who doesn't live downtown are the Jerusalem bagels, which don't look like regular bagels and are different, but so delicious. Also, he seems to be just like a savant with loaf cakes, you know, like different versions of kinds of coffee cakes or pound cakes that are in, you know, a loaf shape. And then he makes wonderful challah, as well as all the viennoiserie they do, you know, all the pastry made with super flaky, buttery dough.
Oh, so that's Bread Lounge in downtown L.A. And moving on to the West Side.
Well, maybe before we go to the West Side, we should like jog over to Pasadena.
Okay, let's jog over there. Let's take the 110.
So Christine Moore's Lincoln might be closed forever, sadly, but her original Little Flower in Pasadena is once again open, serving that community there with the same quality sweets and savories that she always did and which you saw at Lincoln. So scones, different kinds of pastries, little cakes, as well as savories. So she too has this expansiveness that goes from bread, from baguettes and croissants all the way to something that you can bring home for dinner.
All right, moving west, what's next?
Moving west in Hollywood, East Hollywood, is Friends and Family. And what I love about Friends and Family is that the couple, Roxana Julepat and Dan Mattern, each do what they do best. Roxana was one of the original group creating a new grain movement here in Southern California. And all of her breads and pastries have at least 30% of locally grown whole grain in them. She's a fabulous baker in the sourdough vein. Everything is natural yeast. And she moves as easily from bread to pastries. I love her scones. And her viennoiserie is always really interesting, too. It tends to be seasonal. She'll tuck whatever great seasonal fruit is in there. She also has an ice cream case. And then her husband, Dan, is an amazing chef. So the other half of the case that isn't pastry is all great salads and other savory things that you can take home. If I see their fried chicken, you know, which is cold in the case, it's like that perfect kind of picnic fried chicken that you want to eat cold or at room temperature.
Not the dry, greasy version.
Marvelous egg salad. And so once again, you go to one place and you can get, you know, your daily bread and stuff to eat when you're being lazy and you don't want to cook yourself.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Friends and Family. And sticking with the East Side for just a bit, what about Proof in Atwater? They have some delicious pastries.
Proof in Atwater is amazing. She only makes one kind of bread, which is brioche, which is perfect considering how enriched her pastries are. So Na Young Ma from Proof is just super skilled. Everything that you bite into there is like a sigh. You like bite into it and it's like, oh, that was good. And these days during quarantine, she doesn't have a huge inventory, but everything that's there is just delicious. And it's a wonderful place to go splurge.
Okay, we have time for one more, but we're going to have your full list online at kcw.com. So don't despair, listeners.
So
what
let me
is
just
your final offering?
Lodge Bakery, which is in Culver City. they also are part of the new grain movement. They mill a lot of their grain there themselves. Their loaves are super rustic. They last for a really long time, which to me is a mark of a really excellently made loaf of bread. They also have a little small grocery store. They're just selling stuff that they have that they use in inventory. And I have to say the eggs I bought from them were some of the best eggs I've had in a really long while. Mm. They get them from a small farm in Yucaipa. And they also have, they're famous for their giant cinnamon rolls that are like the size of a head. And the same cafe type savories I've talked about before. They have an assortment of salads and sandwiches that are really tasty.
All right, let's get to your sticky bun recipe. First of all, it sounds a little intimidating to make your own sticky buns. I confess to that.
No, I have to say that if you've never made bread before, this actually might be a really easy way in because it's a milk butter based dough. So it's an enriched dough. It's very easy. To be honest, it's a recipe I've been making since I was a child from the Pepperidge Farm baking book.
Priceless.
My parents were from Philadelphia, and sticky buns, I don't know if they still are, but back in the day, sticky buns were a very Philadelphia thing. And every time I would come home from Philly, I'd be like, boy, I really wish we could have those sticky buns. And so I figured out how to make them. And just follow the instructions and you end up with something fabulous. And yes, you do need the tiny bit of corn syrup that they call for in the recipe if you want it super sticky. I use just pecans on the top, and inside you, before you roll the dough up, you put just a cinnamon sugar sprinkle for the swirl. But if you want, you can add a bit of cocoa, which is a nice little addition.
So if you aren't feeling lazy, make the sticky buns. If you are feeling lazy, maybe one of these places you mentioned can sell you a sticky bun.
Or something similar. If you're going to make sticky buns, make the dough today.
Okay.
Bake it before Sunday. It's going to get really hot. Yeah.
So hot, you don't want to mess with all that. All right. The recipe is online at kcrw.com, as well as the list of bakeries that Evan mentioned, plus some more, some extras. So check that out. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, filmmaker Charlie Kaufman is here to talk about his latest movie, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Charlie Kaufman is a filmmaker who's hard to describe. Even he has difficulties describing his work. And he explores that difficulty, the act of creating a movie or a theater production or a relationship in his movies, Being John Malkovich, adaptation, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, movies that have been praised for their inventiveness, their winding trips into the brain, literally, in the case of Being John Malkovich. In his latest movie, he takes that brain trip again while on a real trip. Two characters, a boyfriend and a girlfriend, go on a road trip to visit his parents. Most of the movie is them in the car talking.
It's an odd song to out here in the middle of nothing.
It's from Oklahoma, the musical.
I didn't know you were a fan of musical theater.
Well, I'm not really. Anyway, I just know a few musicals. Oklahoma, Phantom, Carousel, South Pacific, Guys and Dolls, Flower Drum Song, Wicked.
The movie is called I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and filmmaker Charlie Kaufman joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, that line, I'm thinking of ending things, is what the young woman in the car says to herself at the beginning. And so, of course, we think the worst, but then it turns out she's really talking about the relationship. It's a relatively new relationship. And can you just describe the two characters as we first meet them in the car?
Well, the man is named Jake, played by Jesse Plemons. And he is maybe somewhat awkward, maybe too accommodating. She's unnamed, played by Jesse Buckley. And she seems to have a lot of different facets to her personality and to her experience in the world. It's sort of unclear who she is. She's hard to pin down.
She is hard to pin down. She's got various professions, as we learn throughout the movie. She's a scientist. She's a waitress. She's an artist. We don't know her name. Is that from the source material, which was a novel, that she was this kind of vague, hard to pin down character?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is. I mean, I've taken some liberties with that, but yes, the premise is that she is somewhat enigmatic. In the book, she is the narrator, so it's from her point of view, which we kind of maintained in the movie. But the specifics of the different professions and stuff is not in the book, I think.
Let me just play another clip. This starts with her inner monologue, and then it broadens out to another snippet of their conversation.
I'm so uncertain about our future, our lack of it. After all, going to meet your boyfriend's parents is the proverbial next step, isn't it? The truth is, I haven't even told my parents I'm dating Jake. I've never mentioned him, and I don't think I ever will.
She hasn't been feeling well.
Getting old ain't for sissies, as Betty Davis said.
True, although one might just take issue with her use of the word sissy.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yes.
So they do have a very awkward connection, or a lack of connection. It just feels so uncomfortable being in the car with them. And I guess, you know, they're uncomfortable with each other. Why are they so awkward with each other?
Well, you have to watch the movie, I think. I can't really talk about what is revealed in the movie, because I think that's the experience of watching it. But yeah, things are not as they seem.
No, and it's interesting, sort of your exploration of what relationships are and what a romance can be. I will say it's not a happy perspective necessarily on a relationship, and he in fact talks about that in the movie. And this is something that you've explored, obviously, in other movies. Eternal Sunshine comes to mind, and I guess I'm wondering about your viewpoint on romance, on the possibility of romance, of the possibility of romantic love.
Well, it's really complicated. I mean, I'm certainly a sucker for it, but I think that there's a lot of things at play when people first start to see each other, start to get involved romantically, and a lot of it is by necessity is projection, because you don't know each other. And so you've got these ideas and these things that appeal to you, and you kind of project them onto the other person. And I don't think that's sustainable in a relationship if it's go on for any length of time. And some of that is, I think, being explored here. But yeah, I mean, I certainly like it and, you know, and crave it.
And then it's really interesting because you're playing with time, like as you do in many of your movies, where time is fluid and the characters they age back and forth in front of our eyes. And I'm also wondering about your feelings about aging. I couldn't help but think, well, this is, I don't know, I haven't read the source material, so I don't know how closely you adhere to the book in this particular part of it, but the idea of the aging parents and what it means for your own mortality, is that something that you have been thinking about?
Yeah, I sure have. but I love the aging process. No, I'm just kidding. Certainly, I'd say it's more in the movie than it is in the book. I mean, well, no, it's in the book in a certain way, but it's not in the book in the same way.
Can you talk a little bit about Jesse Plemons as Jake? Because initially he bears a similarity to a young Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was in your directorial debut, Synecdoche, New York. And did you want him to play the role because of that? Or was that just a happy coincidence?
I mean, it's just a coincidence. Yeah, I think that it was not my intention. I mean, I guess I see what people, I know that people are saying it and have said it, and I feel like they feel different to me. Maybe their coloring is the same, but I see them both as singular. You know, I know that, I know that people have seen it. I just want to make sure that I'm giving Jesse Plemons the credit and respect that he deserves as an individual actor, and not as a, not like a copy of something or someone else, because he deserves it.
Yeah. And then he is a quite the foil to Jesse Buckley, who plays the young woman. She, I hadn't seen her before, but how did you come to cast her in this role?
I had cast somebody else and they dropped out, and I was speaking to my production designer, and she happened to be in London working on a movie with a director named Thea Sharrock. And she was in the room, she was at her house. And I guess she said out loud that I was looking for somebody. And this director said he has to hire Jesse Buckley. And I had never heard of Jesse Buckley. So I was immediately excited because I love the idea of, you know, finding somebody that I don't know. You know, I was looking at a few other people, and there's a poem in the movie, and I wanted, as an audition, I wanted people to recite the poem because I thought it would be a difficult thing to pull off in the movie because it's long, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, that the person could bring something to it. I think Jesse sent me a tape the next day after we sent her the poem, reciting it, and I'm from memory, but also like brilliantly, really intimate and felt. And that was it. I just wanted her. So I offered it to her. And I'm really, really glad that I did.
Yeah, she's really captivating in this. And there's a moment where she is reciting, well, she recites that poem and she does that really well. But she, then later in the movie, she's reciting a Pauline Kael review of one of my favorite films, the John Cassavetes film, A Woman Under the Influence. And then she does a few of the Jenna Rollins bits that she does in that movie. Can you talk about that scene and why you chose that review and why she's quoting Pauline Kael then, and why you wanted to choose that particular movie to have her talk about?
I think that there are, again, thematic kind of parallels in that movie and the movie that you're watching. And I wanted Pauline Kael's review because I wanted that feeling from Jake that he's not safe with his opinions, that he has this passion for this movie that he thinks is great, that he's been told is great, and therefore he can defend, and then suddenly feel on the defensive because somebody who's smarter than he is telling him that it's a bad movie. But there are references throughout the movie to other things, to pop culture things, to literature, to it's like the stuff that fills people's minds. So Pauline Kael represented this, you know, very opinionated, smart voice telling you that you're wrong.
So there's, you know, you're talking about the stuff that fills people's minds. And so there's an interesting back and forth between the two of them early on in the movie about life and how this idea that life is something that everything wants to live, including bad, and she has a line, including bad movies in your brain, which I love that. Is that from you or is that from the original, from the novel?
That's from me.
That's just a great line. And do you believe that bad movies take up an inordinate position in people's brains? They stick with people even if they don't like the movie?
Yeah, no, I think it's not only bad movies, it's bad everything. She also says that viruses want to live, which I wrote before this pandemic. So
So how do you get rid of it? How do you get rid of that stuff that's clogging our brains? How do we make room for the good stuff?
I think I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm a victim of it, like many other people. But I feel like you probably have to step outside of the stuff that's presented to you, you know, by corporate media, and find things, you know, look for small smaller things and things that are old, you know, and try to expand your world. You know, it's we live in a world right now where our thoughts and our lives are really curated by people who don't care about us. You know, it's all designed by capitalists who want our money, you know. But I do think that you have to step outside of the stuff that people want you to see and want you to think about, and start looking for other things, looking for people who are trying to be, you know, helpful, you know, in the world, you know, really trying to be helpful.
Is that you?
I want to be. I try to be. I can't speak to whether or not I'm successful, but yeah, it's something that I want to do. When I'm writing things, I'm trying to be truthful. And by truthful, I mean truthful to the experience that I've had in the world or the things that I think about. You know, I mean, when I wrote Eternal Sunshine, I wanted to make a story about a relationship that wasn't about, that wasn't a rom-com, that wasn't about, you know, people meeting cute and then falling in love and then the movie's over. This movie was about the stuff that happens after that, which is the stuff that you rarely see in romantic comedies. And so you end up, you know, I think as a young person, feeling like there's some truth out there in this stuff, and that you are just absolutely frustrated in your pursuit of it because it isn't true. And also, you know, memory and fantasy and aging and frustration and the things that I think people deal with in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that the fact is that a lot of our memory is fantasy, because it's not necessarily faithful to the facts.
Yeah, definitely. And it's always subjective. So it's always going to be your version of things. A lot of what you think about, you know, an interaction with somebody is stuff that you can't really ever know, like what they were thinking. You can think you know what they were thinking, but, you know, most of that is made up by you in interactions, because most of the time you don't get to know what other people are thinking. Even if they tell you, it may not be true. But so you construct these narratives, and a lot of that, that'll be your memory of what happened, but it may not be what happened.
Mm. Does that lead to a life of, at the end, of being alone and of loneliness? Because you can never know, or you can never share the same reality?
Yeah, I mean, we are, as they say, born alone and die alone. So I guess there is some of that, but I think you can work. I don't know. I mean, I try, you know, to work towards being honest, and maybe you can do that in a relationship and you get some sort of intimacy, some real intimacy, as opposed to, like, you know, fantasy intimacy.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
No, it was my pleasure. I feel like I've just gotten out of some sort of therapy session. So,
well, hopefully it was a good therapy session.
I don't know. I'll let you know.
Charlie Kaufman, screenwriter and director of the new movie, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. It's on Netflix beginning September 4th. And that's it for us today. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.